podcast, The Worst Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 14 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? Today, I'm speaking to Kate Stannis, who is the Global Chief Creative Officer of Saatchi & Saatchi. Ah, now you're impressed, eh? Global Chief Creative Officer of Saatchi & Saatchi. That does sound incredibly high-powered. I don't know if you've met Kate at all, anyone listening to this, but I'm sure when you hear a title like that, you're thinking of a woman in a trouser suit pointing at people in Nairobi going, we need more of this, or someone equally high-powered and intimidating in Tokyo saying, we need more of that. Yeah, she's not like that at all, really. She's incredibly nice and really easy to have a chat with and great to get along with. I first met her in 2010 or 11, I think. I did a couple of stints of freelancing at Saatchi & Saatchi. And, you know, I'd heard the name a bunch of times, particularly connected with St. Luke's, but I'd never met her. And she was just really, really lovely person to work into. And so when, I'll mention this at the end of the podcast as well, but when I asked around the people in my agency in LA who they'd like me to interview, one of them mentioned Kate's name. And I thought, yeah, she'd be great. I mean, aside from the fact that I would like to, you know, interview as many women as possible in the situation, because it's quite easy demographic-wise to find middle-aged white guys, as you'll see in the future and have seen already. And I'm saying that as pretty much one of them. But, you know, the women who've really made it to the absolute top of this industry are, you know, depressingly fewer and further between than they should be. Kate's one of them, so it was great to manage to have an hour of her time. And just to give you an idea what happens when I do these recordings, you know, I record them on Skype or whatever, and then I, at some point a few days later, go back and listen, cutting out a few ums and ahs, and just in case there are a few glitches. And in listening back to what Kate was saying, I got a real sense of her being a real original. I mean, you'll hear over the course of her career that she did things that may not have seemed like the right or logical or perfect thing to do, and just went on and did them anyway in the true spirit of a creative person. And I think one way or another, they all worked out. You know, I'm not saying any of them were necessarily 100% perfect, but, you know, in making those choices in her career, she's gone on this interesting trajectory to the point where she is now by doing what we should all be doing, which is, you know, taking a chance, taking a risk, going out and, you know, having a go at something that might be a little bit different. And, you know, she's done that to a brilliant extent and made a fantastic career out of it. So I think that's just about enough jabbering on from me. Let's go into the chat with Kate. So, hi, Kate. Thanks enormously for taking the time to speak to me today. That's very kind.
Absolutely. No, total pleasure.
Okay.
It's lovely that I'm talking to you in sunny LA and I'm in cold, miserable London.
Yeah, I won't reveal how it's slightly not that sunny because it's January. It's a little bit overcast, but I'll pretend. Oh, my God, it's so sunny here. Wow.
Yeah, look at gorgeous.
Yeah, right by the beach. Cool. Well, like I normally start these conversations, I just was wondering why and how you got into the business in the first place.
I think probably as per most people, it sort of doesn't follow a proper path and a series of events that happen. Mine probably different because my dad did exactly what I do, and he was the creative director of Leo Burnett's, but a copywriter. So I probably, the one thing I knew was I never wanted to do advertising but because obviously, like all good, you know, children, you don't want to follow suits and you want to do your own thing. So I was really, really adamant that was the last thing I ever wanted to do. But sort of in a series of weird events, I ended up doing art at art college, ended up loving design, ended up doing a bit of advertising, realised I quite liked it, and then worked with a fantastic woman called Carol Thompson, who very much wanted to do advertising as a writer. And she sent our portfolios off to BBH in the summer to do a placement. And we got a placement, and I said I didn't want to do it, and she said, oh, come on, it'll be fun. And of course, we did it, and I fell in love with it, and decided that's what I really wanted to do. So that's how it all started.
That's funny, because when I spoke to Mary, she made a connection with Ron Collins, and obviously through Damon there was a connection there. Did you make any use of your dad at all in making that happen, improving your work or contacts or something?
Not really. The only thing that happened was I saw a couple of people, you know, in the bid. Then once I decided I quite liked the idea, Carol and I sort of spent, you know, going around with your portfolio, seeing people work, doing work placements. And quite a few people would say, are you any relation to Bob Stanners? And I'd sort of have to own up. Or I either said no, or I sort of said, actually, he's my dad. And I would get, you know, varying responses to either he was a miserable old bastard or that he really supported them in early years. So that was it. And I never really talked about work, except when I sort of really got my first proper job, I suppose, was at Goldgreener's Trot, where Mary was.
Yeah.
And Damien and Mary were there. And by that time, I worked with a guy called Tim Hearn. And the first thing we were given to work on was Flake. And I just thought, oh my God, of all the things, my dad had started the Flake campaign, you know, 20 years before. And I just said, I don't believe it. You know, it had moved agencies to GGT. And there I was. The very first commercial I ever made was a bloody Flake commercial, which was the campaign my dad had started. Yeah. So I was like, oh God.
And was it one of the, I'm going to use huge inverted commas here, sexy girl Flake ads?
It was a sexy girl Flake ad. It was a sexy girl in a bath.
Oh, I remember that. Yes.
And I remember sort of, that's the first time I spoke to my dad about anything. And I said to him, he said, what are you working on? And I said, well, I've just had my first ad bought, and it's going to be a TV commercial. And he said, what is it? And I said, it's a Flake ad. He went, okay. He said, and where do you open on? And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, what's open on? And I went, it's open on a bathroom. And he went, oh, my God. He said, haven't you learned anything? It should be open on beach, open on sea, open on blue sky, open on poppy field, not somewhere that you can shoot in a studio in London, which is where we ended up. So we were the first ever Flake ad to be shot in Pinewood, not on location in South Africa, South America, or New Zealand.
Oh, kind of a shame, but it sort of seems maybe that's appropriate for the... Were you the first woman to write a sexy girl Flake ad?
Yeah, probably was, actually, yeah. And it was all based on my idea of what I thought was a really top night in, which was a glass of wine, chocolate, and a bar.
That's my idea of a really good night in as well. I don't know if that's my feminine side, but that's fantastic, yeah. So you mentioned Tim. How did you team up with him? Because he was your partner for quite a long time, wasn't he?
So Tim and I were partners for, 14 years probably. And we met in a pub. We met in a pub in Amersham, which is where we both brought up. And through a mutual friend. And we sort of just got chatting. And he was working at McCann Erickson. I was working at a place called GGK, and Carol decided to go back to Liverpool, and I didn't have a partner, and sort of Tim just spoke to me and said, you know, I realise I'm a really shit art director, I think I'd be a better writer, and I said, well, I'm certainly not a writer, but hopefully we'd be better art director than you, so let's give it a go. So we freelanced and then got a job at GGT. So finally, after, you know, it all doesn't happen that easily, but after lots of trudging around and working on millions of spec briefs and taking our portfolio in and so forth.
And was that under Dave Trott then?
Yeah, so Dave was the creative director, and there was Dave Waters was and Nick Ray and Dave Cook. They were all there at the time, and I think Axe and Steve had just left to set up How Henry, and so there was deemed to be an office spare, and so we got in doing a placement, and then we managed to hang on to a job. So and stayed there, I think, probably 8 years in the end. And Dave, in the end, left, and Tim Mellors joined. And so we ended up having, you know, a transition of very different styles of creative director. But, I mean, working for Dave was utterly brilliant. And I think probably we did, you know, I think we worked for him for 5 years. I reckon we did probably, you know, a probably 20 years' work in 5 years with the amount of work he produced in his style of how he ran the department. So lots and lots of experience and learning how to think, learning how to plan. I always say Dave Trott was the best planner in the world. Still think that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously he's becoming even more of a legend on the other side of things, on the sort of Twitter and blog thing. I'm wondering, because I've looked through a bunch of DNADs from that time. So there was a point where Tim took over and Graham Fink was there as well, wasn't he?
Yeah. So Finky was our head of art, and you know, it was. I think I always thought I was really lucky because Dave was a phenomenal thinker and sort of really structured in teaching you how to kind of get to a thought. And then Tim and Graham were great craftsmen. And I think learning, you know, having that ability to sort of learn from these masters of very different skills was almost, it was like changing agencies without ever changing agency. And, you know, I think it was a time where craft, you know, Len Cheeseman was our head of type. And Guy Kroll was our head of TV, and Kerry Millett was our head of art, and they were just all really extraordinary people. You know, I remember one of the first things, apart from the Flakehead, was the first thing we did with Nick Lewin, who was the director, and then I think very early on we did an Access commercial, and it was Nick Park from Aardman Films was the guy doing the animation. So we got to work with incredible people really, really early on, and I think we probably didn't realise how lucky we were.
And was there anything like, because I know Dave Trott was a really big figure in the industry, and at that time I wasn't in advertising, but the impression I got was that Graham Fink was this weird star of the industry as well, and probably Tim as well. Was that a weird situation to be in when they had such big profiles and stuff as well?
Yeah, and I think really, really, you know, amazingly strong personalities.
Yeah.
So, you know, and Dave, you know, was wonderful, but and his personality and style, you know, sometimes you'd be working on something, you'd be sort of like playing music, he'd hear it coming through the corridor and he'd just shout out saying, a soundtrack is not an idea. get back. And he used to do reviews and he used to go in and he'd say, is it a good idea? And you'd think, shit, I'm stuck here, because if I say yes, he'll say no, it's not. And if I say no, he'll say, why are you coming in with one? So you kind of couldn't win. So he was, and then with Graham and Tim, you know, I think the art of storytelling was amazing with Tim. And then, you know, what I learned from Graham was just real attention to the art direction and the craft. And sort of really pouring over that. So I think that was just, as an art director, a privilege to work with him. But yeah, hilarious personalities that, you know, you would not want to be in the same room with all of them at the same time.
Yeah, and I think one of the bigger campaigns you did then was Cadbury's Cream Eggs.
We did a cream egg campaign that was, but we based it on star signs.
Yeah.
So we did them, and we did Tim Mellors. We did one which he was Krabby Delors and his Swiss Army claws. And
yeah.
That was, we got Ronald Searle to draw these brilliant cartoons, and it was a hamster with hundreds of like arms and prongs. And I think we did Lady Jane Stanners and her twin with no manners, which was actually Ronald Searle's suggestion, not mine. So we had to, and that was for Gemini's. And it was all about how do you eat yours, yeah.
Did you start the how did you eat yours thing?
No, I think that was Dave Cook, maybe, I think, because I think that's the other thing about probably it was an incredibly interesting environment that Dave created, which was, he always talked about, he set up GGT to try and kind of beat John Webster. Right. So he had a whole department to try and be better than John Webster, was all, as he always talked about it. And so it was an extraordinarily competitive environment, but also, I think, surprisingly collaborative. And while none of you wanted to collaborate and all of you wanted to own an idea, what Dave would be brutal about is he'd go, I really like that idea from you, but I want you guys to execute it. And you really had to, you know, I mean, in a way, that was a much more modern way of working, a way we would advocate to work now, was very much, but it was highly competitive, but equally, and you thought, oh God, you'd be gutted if your idea then got handed out to the department and everyone could work on it. So, you could find that you might have written an end line and someone else would end up doing the campaign, and you'd be, oh God, but because your specific execution wasn't deemed good enough. So quite brutal.
Yeah, I think I may have remembered him saying that he would put all the work up that at the end of the month or something and see who had actually made any work that month. And it was all very...
God, yeah. He had, what you had was, he had whiteboards up on the wall, and and on there, they would be colour-coded, and I think it was black, red and green or something. And if you had nothing in production, you were really on the edge of being booted out, you know. Yeah. And so there would be being bought by client, being bought by Dave, being bought by client, being in production. And if you weren't any of those, you really were on your, you know. And what you'd do is your boards would work up a hierarchy, but you could come in one morning and they'd jump back down three rungs. So you'd be like, oh my God. Oh my God! Or if you'd got something bought or made and it was great, you'd hop right up as well. So you know, it worked both ways. But I mean, it was pretty scary.
And was it a big jump to go from there to Bates Dorland? Must have been quite a different situation.
That was funny because we went at the time we were working with Tim Mellors and. We sort of we'd been there seven or eight years, and we decided we wanted to change. And actually, what we really started thinking about was we quite liked the idea of working. You know, we talked to a couple of agencies, and we sort of felt GGT was such a culture of sort of, it was very boutique-y, very creative, and we. Probably the one thing was it was very British and very domestic. And I think we just in the back of our minds were quite intrigued by maybe working on something more international. So the appeal was that and Andrew Cracknell, who was another big personality, and convinced us that would be a really sort of interesting step. And I think we enjoyed it. We did it for not very long. I think of all the places that have worked, that was the shortest time. And purely because we then got approached by Dave and Narish, who were starting to set up this idea of St. Luke's. They'd been doing Chiat Day. And Chiat Day ended up being sold and taken over by TBWA. And in the UK, it kind of ceased to exist, and sort of some of it became TVWA, and some of it, the Chiat Day part, was kind of cut adrift in a way. And so there was a group of people that decided to set up what became known as St. Luke's. And at that point, Dave and Narish were the creative directors, and they approached him and myself and said, would you join us in this kind of crazy adventure of setting up an agency? And it was with David Abrahams and Andy Law. And so it was quite brief at Dorland's, but fun. And we did get to work on that big international stuff that we kind of maybe regretted. But we got to work on things like Mars, which, you know, for our sins. But we learned the tricky stuff about what makes something more European, more international, some of the tough stuff that you kind of... So I think we were really pleased that... And we carried on a tradition that GGT, we'd always done chocolate and beer. So we carried on doing chocolate and beer. We did different beer advertising for Grolsch and Stone's bitter, I think, and then we did some Mars stuff and some Heinz stuff. So it was that kind of bigger international stuff we got a chance to look at. But then weren't there that long before we just sort of got this offer that we just couldn't refuse, which was being part of a whole new kind of way of working that was just thrilling. And it just to work with a great group of people. So it was brief, but I think we learned the stuff that we learned, and I think it held us in good stead for the what we did next.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. This is going to be interesting for anyone who wasn't in advertising in the mid-90s to actually get their head around how revolutionary St. Luke's really was at that point.
Yeah.
I mean, we now accept agencies called things like Mother and, you know, Lucky Generals or whatever. But back in the mid-90s, the idea of having an agency name that wasn't the three guys or the, whatever who found it would be really unusual. So I don't know if you could talk a little bit about what the differences really were in St. Luke's, because there were a lot of them.
Yeah, there were a lot. It was based on a principle of... Well, there were quite a few found them. Look, my lights have gone off now. Can you see me?
Yes, I can.
I'm in darkness. One, it was co-owned. So we set it up so that everyone was an owner. So it worked as a cooperative. Probably more similar to, well, John Lewis in the UK mm-hmm. is one of the bigger partnerships.
Yeah.
That is run in that way, and but often legal firms are run in that way. But it's sort of it was a co-owned principle where everyone had shares, and we issued shares every year. So there was a sense that sort of everyone had a say in how the company was run. Sometimes that got us into terrible hot water, and we did really dumb ass things. But we also had a principle where it was all about collaboration. So it was all about working with our clients and a sense that, you know, we would work on ideas that were agnostic in terms of media as well. So it was in many ways probably a lot before its time. And often I think possibly we struggled with sort of finding outlets. We set it up with a principle that we would never enter any creative awards. And we did that because I think there was a feeling that you could all too easily have your eye on juries rather than an audience and on behalf of a client. So we never entered creative awards. And I think that was quite refreshing. So it was only when I joined Saatchi's that I even really knew Cannes existed. So I literally had no idea what it was. So it was a wonderful bubble to exist in, where you really just cared about making what you believe to be great work for your clients. And that was it. We worked in a way that we had no offices. So we were one of probably the first agencies to hot desk. And we tried to, and so a lot of the stuff we did, we were very early adopters of, I mean, people will laugh, but early adopters of Apple, early adopters of mobiles inside the office, because we had no fixed place. So everything was about kind of partnering technology as well. So it kind of was, I think, just a principle of trying to work together with different types of skills. So we also tried to make sure we build together different kind of creative teams, trying to break up that copywriter, writer, art director relationship, not to just break it up, but introduce different skills to it. And bring media, I think very much media coming back into play. It had been split off, you know, a few years before, but understanding the role of media in ideas was very much part of it as well. So it was, I think we look back and probably think, yeah, it did do things very differently, but it was probably some of the sort of cultural pieces that it got known for and being a bit of a hippy-dippy kind of crazy nut house, which it was, you know. Like we went, you know, we made chronic business decisions. We would make, you know, we kind of followed the hearts and minds of people who work there. So someone might say, we quite fancy opening an office in Stockholm, so we did. Give any real reason for it. And it would just be, or someone would say, I really want to do a feature film, so we did one, you know, and we tried different things with no business acumen whatsoever. But I think it was about believing that it was sustaining the people that worked there and satisfying their creative urges was part of what we believed the agenda was. So, I think it was maybe not a huge, as business successes go, maybe not. But as you say, I think it had a big effect on the business at the time.
Yeah, I think, was it interesting also being, I mean, it felt like campaign spotlight was in your direction constantly in about 95, 96. Did you feel like, you know, I guess new agencies really want that publicity initially, but I felt like maybe the rest of the industry was almost judging St. Luke's and almost not waiting for it to fail, but going, is this hippie bullshit really going to work out? Did you feel that?
I know. Yeah, absolutely. And we were given, I think we got agency year twice. And, yeah. And, you know, really, really so typical of us. I think we gave it back the first time. Yeah, because, and, you know, then we go, oh, Christ, what? Twats. But but it was just because we sort of slightly unaware of ourselves, and also I don't think we were deliberately ourselves, but we probably did some things that meant the industry did sort of want you to fail, and I think some of the stuff we did was maybe look like it was poking a finger up to the industry, but actually I think it was just trying to do something, get back to the heart of what it is we do, which is communicating stuff in an engaging way on behalf of clients. And I think we were trying to be as pure as we could be about it and explore different formats. So longer form formats, yeah. Branded content was something we really, really started to play with. The idea that design and invention could be part of it, content, entertainment could be part of it, none of which we did particularly successfully.
But the awards thing's quite interesting because, I mean, I have this weird, like, wouldn't it be great if awards didn't exist sort of fantasy. And then I talked to Mark Denton about it, and he says, you know, quite rightly, it was in a lot of ways the only currency creatives really had, a measurable way of saying, I am a good creative here, can I move this amount of money? Did you find the fact that you famously didn't enter awards made it harder to attract people?
I think it was really interesting. And then, you know, when you sort of step out of that world and come, I came to Sarches, you know, I was on one hand, because I was totally out of the loop on awards, it just wasn't on my agenda at all. And I think one of the things we realised is somehow you have to compensate for that. You have to it is a currency, it has become quite a useful currency for us as creatives. I think it got out of control, and I think that's why we thought actually just being known for good work should be enough. I think we probably courted publicity as compensation for the fact we weren't able to, you know, offer young creatives the chance to win awards. I think it still is a useful thing on your CV, and you can see how people top them up and say, oh yeah, you know, this many Grand Prix or this many. And because we just didn't do that, I think we did have to find ways to give people a sort of sounding board and a platform. So often that would become the fact that they were at St. Luke's. It also meant our work had to be bloody famous. Mm. And stand up and make a noise on its own. But interestingly, even when I look back at GGT, GGT's reason and Dave Trott's reason to exist was never awards. It was always to create sort of publicity that money can't buy on behalf of our clients, and to create work that got the chat in the pub or in the school playground. So in many ways, St. Luke's wasn't that different.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think also, I mean, it's very interesting that it was started off and run by a pair of creative people, because that's a pretty unusual situation as well. Did that make, I mean, maybe it informed some of those weird business decisions you made, but did you have a grown-up there as well?
No, we didn't. That was the At first we realised there were four creative directors and no creatives. We had no one in our department, it was just us. And actually our grown-up was David Abraham, who's gone on to run Channel 4 and many other things in between, and Andy Law. But the reality was none of us were. We did one pitch. I remember one pitch we did for the government. So the New Labour had been voted in. I suppose it was 96 was when Tony Blair's New Labour came in. And we kind of had pitched to do some government work. Now, usually you had to get on a roster for that work. And that would take, you know, you'd sit on that roster for a few years and then you might get a chance to actually do some work. And we managed to get straight on to get down to the last two some work for, I think it was the New Deal, in fact, was a sort of encouraging, it was a work scheme. And we sort of had a two-hour pitch that ended up being whittled down to having to be 15 minutes in front of Gordon Brown and the Prime Minister, etc., at number 10. And David Abraham kept marching us into an office and timing us to within an inch of our lives, because we were so hopeless at anything. And he was trying to be the grown-up. Then on the day of the pitch, we were going down Whitehall in a taxi, and he said, "Okay, Kate, you've got the work." I went, "Oh my God, I haven't got the work." He went, "What do you mean?" I said, "I've left it in my flat." And I said, "It's okay, we can turn around." He said, "We can't turn around. We're just going to have to go and do it without the work." And all that training just went out the window, where we had to sort of improvise on how. But we won the pitch, so, you know. Can't have been all bad.
Yeah, it sounds like New Labour at that time would be the perfect St Luke's client. Was there a kind of ethos behind the clients you went for at that time? Because you had Boots and IKEA and things like that, did you?
Yeah, Boots, IKEA. I think what it was there was a sense that I think actually because it had such a strong culture and ethos, certain clients were attracted to the brand and the sort of work that it produced. And I think there was Eurostar, Clark Shoes, and a lot of them were brands that wanted to turn around, or were new to the kind of country or a new proposition and wanted to kind of talk in a different way. And I think that's the New Labour thing, was very much that. They wanted a new sort of language to talk in a very different way from years of what would have been the sort of more analogy-led work that had been part of the former government, the Tory government. So, yeah, I think a lot of our clients were like that. To start with.
Yeah. The one thing I remember, because I only went there once, because I was in the same year at Watford as Suzanne and Al, and I went to meet Suzanne for a drink, and I went to your offices, and what I thought was really cool was that you had a separate room for each client. You had like a Eurostar room and a Boots room, and it was set up very much, I think, was Eurostar, it wasn't set up like a train, was it? Or was it?
Yeah,
it was.
So each of the rooms, so we had, so they were either done like the client, so, you know, the IKEA room would be IKEA, or the Eurostar room was a train carriage with seats. But then we had the Boots number 17 was a teenager's bedroom. And then the Radio 1 room was like a mixing room. It's all blacked out, and that's where all sorts of naughty things would happen at parties. And the Midland Bank room was very, very straight and proper.
Yeah, quite right. Well, yeah. I mean, I'm slightly embarrassed to say I'm not 100% sure what St Luke's is up to at the moment, but what was the journey that happened? Because I guess there must have been a huge sort of momentum energy at the beginning and lots of goodwill and things like that. How did it sustain at that time? Was it up and down? What happened later on?
I think with all agencies, there's ebbs and flows. And I mean, I think the thing I've learned is nothing's sustainable. And an agency is about the group of people that are there at any given time. And you have to allow those groups. You know, there's no such thing as one rock star that's going to change anything. I don't believe that. I think teams of people make a culture and make a place. And it's about getting those teams right and you're wanting the right thing. And I think great successes are these are teams of people that are aligned and they have a vision and they're going in one direction. And at some time, that's going to fall apart a little bit. And after sort of 10 years, I think there were different agendas. People wanted different things. Narrative left, David left. And I think, you know, we went through different changes. And I think we all kind of got to a point where and David Abraham left. And I think everyone went to do their different things. And we all mourned the loss of what it had been for a period of time. But I think what we realized was we thought we'd created something that would always change and mold to what we as individuals wanted to do. And in a way, we tried to make that work. So we tried to make it into a branded content agency because some of us wanted to do it. Or we tried to make it into a production company because some of us wanted to do it. We set it up in Stockholm because some of us wanted to do it. We thought we'd go and set up in India because some of us wanted to do it. And we realized that actually that wasn't the business, shouldn't be like that. And so in the end, I think we grew up a little bit and we realized that actually it was okay for people to go off and do their thing they wanted to do without the others, and that meant leaving. And I think, you know, a lot of what happened was we got to that point where it wasn't what we wanted it for ourselves to be anymore, and chose different paths. But there were a huge amount of tumultuous arguments and, you know, I mean, it would just be a constant, you know, it was sort of everyone knew each other so well. It was like a very open but aggressive marriage.
Interesting.
And I thought, and, you know, so, I mean, I ended up leaving sort of at a point where I was pregnant and having my son, and I sort of realized, I thought that ended up in my head thinking that's a good time to go, you know, it just feels that I'm about to have a new chapter and I should just go off and properly do that, and that was sort of when I left, although I ended up doing a failed startup very quickly after it called Boy Meets Girl, probably too quickly, which lasted, you know, about 18 months or maybe a year. And then I ended up coming and being asked to join Sarches. So,
well, can I just go back a little bit further? Because some people have expressed an interest in when they have a long term partner and that comes to a conclusion. I guess you and Tim stopped working at some point during Luke's year. How did that happen and whose instigation was it?
It's funny, isn't it? It's such an odd thing that you spend all this time working together and really become so close. You are, you know, together so much of the time. You grow up together. You kind of do different stuff together. You know, when you go on the extraordinary adventures together on shoots, you have real highs and lows. I think lots of things happened. One, I think we kind of just had a moment where we probably had enough of each other. And also we kind of were realizing we were enjoying doing different things. Tim loved being the writer and I really loved being a creative director, realizing my limitations as an art director. And so we kind of just naturally found we were migrating to doing very different jobs. And so we did. And Tim went off and did do the Stockholm office. And I think it was a chance for us to kind of see if we could. Also, I think as a creative team, and I often say this to people, you sort of, part of you dies because you become lazy. And, you know, that, you know, you become sort of, because you are only, you know, you are, I mean, Dave Trott always said with us that we were, the sum of the parts was greater. And I think we, for a long time, we've become second guessing what each other did. And, you know, when we split up, you really had to relearn the bit that you kind of had given over to the other person. And Tim was not only a genius writer, but a genius editor of ideas. And I was terrible at that. I just spew out ideas, most of which were shit. And so, you know, I had to learn to self-edit in a way that I hadn't before, which is, as everyone knows, as a creative director, is quite a core skill that you need. So yes. I had to really, really learn that quite quickly. And, you know, so I think those things, and it was painful. And years later, we ended up sort of not working together again, but working in, Tim came and worked in Sarches again. So we did get a chance to work together again, but in a different way, not as a creative team, but sort of in the same building, which was great. But yeah, we just needed to go off and pursue the different stuff, really.
Cool. And the idea of starting an agency when you've got a young son, does that, I mean, maybe, I don't know if that was anything to do with its success or not, but that seems like an interesting thing to take on at that time of life, really.
Yeah, I think it was really stupid. but, you know, you kind of don't, I mean, I think the thing is with what you can easily look back at stuff and think of them as careers, but actually, I think they're just a series of stuff that happens to you, and you kind of go, oh, that might be interesting. For me, anyway, it's not, I've never had a burning idea to do one or other. It's just that a group of people present themselves, and I think I love those people and I love the ambition of it. That probably was never going to spell the success of Boy Meets Girl, and I think it was born out of a sort of desire to create a properly different agency that did architecture, it did design, it did promotion and branded content. And I think the difficulty was we didn't quite find the audience for that at the time. And I also did it with my husband, which maybe isn't ideal. And maybe the ideal of it was more this notion I had of the fact that I loved the idea we'd all be working together, it would be wonderful, new baby. And the reality was possibly it wasn't so wonderful and sort of probably never quite felt right. And I suspect it was because I couldn't give it 100% at a time when I did have a newborn baby and something had to give, and I think probably the startup was not something I put absolutely everything into, like I think you have to.
Yeah, and I think actually when you look back at St. Luke's and talking to you now, I'm sitting there thinking how many things were then in common with Mother. It's almost like Mother took on a lot of St. Luke's stuff and yeah. Made it a little bit more successful in certain ways. And perhaps Boy Meets Girl, you know, was ahead of its time again. And there was, you know, there's a place for an agency like that now, but maybe in 2004 or five, whenever it was, it wasn't quite the time.
It wasn't, I don't think it was quite right. And I think the missing link was media partnerships and how that worked. And I think finding, and, you know, actually now it's something we're all trying to do in a very different way. And I think I agree with you. And actually, St. Luke's was very much born out of How Henry, when you think about it as well. Yeah. You know, that had been the wave that had changed everything at that time. You know, GGT before it, How Henry was born off GGT with Axe and Steve. And then, you know, Chiat Day, obviously, over in the States, a very different sort of feeling of agency. And then, St. Luke's bringing on that different feel. Yeah.
But it's interesting how all these agencies you just mentioned kind of had a really incredible burst of time and then maybe it wasn't their time. So rather than maybe the traditional route where, you know, agencies like AMV or BBH have succeeded for a long time in a more conventional way, I think maybe agencies you were at or Hal Henry showed us the way of how things could be, but it was almost like the reach was so far that it couldn't quite sustain it.
It's not, yeah, maybe, and I think you're right. I think the sustainability of and I think in many ways then some of it is based on naivety, a sort of belief that something can happen and not seeing, you know, where it can't. So I think it's quite interesting. I agree. I think Mother have been you know, they have kept it going. BBH have had, you know, extraordinary success for those years, but also had a few dips, didn't it?
Yeah.
Over the years, and then had come back, you know, but always with a core of strong, beautiful work.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think maybe we do need some of those. It's like having a challenger brand out there, isn't it? One that makes us all look and go, actually, and it probably makes all the other agencies better. And maybe they're there to, you know, keep some of the more established agencies refreshing themselves.
Yeah, and we were talking, because I work on Apple, we were talking about Apple the other day, and the fact that, you know, Steve Jobs didn't really invent many of these things that were that Apple's famous for, but actually someone else had done it not quite right before, and he ended up looking at that and going, ah, but if we did it this way, this way, and this way, that thing which has a germ of a great idea could be amazing. And I think having that perspective on the outside is probably easier than being in the middle of it and going, should we open an office in Stockholm, you know?
I mean, one of the things I've learned is, I think partly when I started and with Dave Trott, you know, one of the criteria always looked at work was originality. And actually, I think, as you say, with the likes of Steve Jobs, I think now sort of going, actually, you can improve on what is there. And that is its own originality. And I think there is a sort of sense of, you don't have to just revolutionize, you can evolve. And some of those agencies that have cleverly evolved are more sustainable, but the ones that come in with a big bang and want to create the revolution, but then they kind of burn and fizzle out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, after Boy Meets Girl, you went to the, I think, polar opposite of starting up, say, St. Luke's or Boy Meets Girl, and being the ECD of a, you know, a very famous and enormous agency, outpost of an agency network. So how did that come about, and why did you think it was the right thing for you to do at that time?
I think it was, it didn't feel like the right thing at all. I sort of left, and I think there was, I got rung up, and it was Richard Heitner, who was here at the time, rang up and said, you know, I was told that I couldn't talk to you because you'd set up your own agency, blatantly not now, would you come in and have a chat? And I said, no, absolutely not. I mean, Sarches is so different to anything that I've ever done. I've only ever worked in these small agencies, and I think that's what I love. And he said, I think you should just come in and have a chat and meet people. And I was, no, I really, to be perfectly honest, I was terrified. And I just, as much as it, as you say, it always had been the establishment. And I, in a way, always worked for the anti-establishment and being part of it. And maybe it was my own growing up, but when I did come and talk to people, I just thought they were the most incredible bunch of people. And I realised that actually in here was the original startup. That kind of culture had never gone away. So my perception of it was sort of really what they built rather than what they were. And actually what they were is still what it is now. And it is sort of, it's sort of written on the step that we've actually just moved from 80 Charlotte Street to 40 Chancery Lane. And it says nothing's impossible. And there really is that spirit. So there's a little bit of the revolutionary is a little bit at the heart of this brand, I think. And I think that's what somehow made me go, maybe it's not quite as corporate and grown up as I thought it was. And when you think about what it had been as well, it was the agency that you kind of always kind of grew up and looked at. The only other time I'd ever been in the agency was to see a great friend of mine, Chris Clark, who ran the Toyota account here, and my flatmate actually lived here with a guy called Ewan Pidgeon. I lived with him, and he worked here. So I used to come to the Pregnant Man and have a few pints, or go to the Carpenters. So that was really my only experience. So the day I got hired, I walked in and I met 350 people in reception. I was bloody terrified, I can tell you. Didn't know what to say to them, other than I suddenly found myself realising it was a total honour to have been invited and to have my chance to be part of of, you know, part of it, and hopefully part of its reinvention as well, and trying to make it a modern agency that delivers sort of modern solutions and ideas for clients. But it's quite it's a bit of a burden to be part of Saatchi's sometimes, because of it's one, it's still, you know, the name everyone's heard of.
Yeah, it's amazing how that's sustained, isn't it? Because that's how it was in the 80s, and still no other agency has become publicly known.
Yeah, and I love that, and I love the fact it's a British agency, and that's managed to kind of export itself from the Saatchi brothers to the world.
Yeah.
It still is the one that people have heard of.
Yeah, and were you following Dave Droger, or was there a gap, or how did that?
Dave was here, then Tony Granger.
Oh, yeah.
I followed Tony. Yeah. So Tony was here and then went to be the creative lead of Saatchi New York. Yeah. And I came into London. It was great. Dave was wonderful. He rang me up and he said, I'm in town. Would you like a chat? I said, I'd love a chat. I'd love any help I can get. And it was really wonderful to hear him talk and his sort of passion for the brand and sort of the journey he was on with it, the journey Tony was on with it. But I think the person that was incredible for me was Bob Isherwood, who was the global creative director at the time and responsible for hiring me. And he was a great source of inspiration, actually, and wisdom.
Yep.
In terms of taking on such a big task, really.
In the time that I freelanced there for some quite big-ish sort of chunks around 2009 or 10, I think, obviously Paul was there too. It seemed like you guys worked together in a really seamless sort of way, even though you shared an office. I mean, it was kind of amazing that one of you would be in and one of you would be out, and it all worked really well. How did that all happen and come about?
Paul, what I sort of felt was, on the one hand, I kind of get the role of a creative director, and maybe you get your understanding of being one person looking after the whole. But I've also always felt that there should be, you know, when you're doing a role, you should be instrumental and not just ornamental. And I just like doing work. And I've always thought Paul Silberman was really one of the best writers there really is.
Yeah.
And I really thought that if he could work here, I would love that, and I would really, really love the opportunity to, you know, share a desk with him and do some work with him and run an agency with him. So it just felt that it brought back a real craft, a real discipline, and it was just amazing having that chance to, as you say, sit across a room with him. And we did, it sort of worked. It sort of, I think we helped each other. We would do our own thing as well. And, you know, I think he really is one of the great talents that we have.
And did you divide it up in a deliberate way? Like, I'll do either these accounts or
it
these aspects?
Like that. We just sort of, it literally would just sort of somehow happen.
All right.
And I quite like that. It was very organic. There was no process to it, and sometimes we'd just sit and kind of between us do something. Sometimes Paul would naturally take something on and I wouldn't, and vice versa. So it kind of always felt quite a natural way of working, and kind of really just working as a team, playing to your weaknesses and strengths and realising. And I think something Magnus, our CEO, in London always says, it's playing in position. I think one of the things learning, you know, what are your strengths, what are your weaknesses, accepting when you should back off and you don't really have a clue what you're talking about, and accepting when people are way better than you is one of the great skills to learn. And I think having Paul there was just because the other thing is, I think, you know, the bit I really enjoy is always learning. And I just, you know, I think it's such a privileged job to work with uber talented people, meet people every day and learn something. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, one of the things that Adam and I really, it was like a really amazing surprise when they say, so you're going to work on Guinness into John Pallant? Because we were like, John Pallant? Like, first of all, the weird way it was all divided up, you went upstairs or downstairs and people on different accounts. But I thought, oh my God, we're going to work with John Pallant. That's incredible. So there's this weird depth of Saatchi's that was sort of behind the, I guess, the initial, you know, part that you saw that was even bigger and even more amazing.
And there's so many, you know, that I think that, as you say, there's part of that, you know, there are people here like John, the most extraordinary talent that has sort of worked on amazing campaigns, extraordinary writer. And then there's a sort of, unlike working at places like St. Luke's that had a little bit of a fuck-off attitude and therefore the industry thought fuck off, there is something about Saatchi's that somehow people want Saatchi's to succeed, I think, and there is goodwill about it. And so you sort of feel that there's a sort of sense that people want it to work because somehow that then the industry is working. Yeah. And so, I mean, I had a lovely chat with Anthony Easton just before we moved offices, just before Christmas, and he's a filmmaker now, and he'd been working here as a creative years ago. And he walked into reception, he said, I want to make a documentary about the building, literally as we're leaving the building. And I just thought, how brilliant that he's someone that was a creative here, and now he's making a documentary about the building and what happened in it, you know. And there is, as I say, there's a sort of sense of it, you know, all the people that have been part of it. It's a great education in our industry.
Yeah.
We did a birthday party, on our 40th, which was, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, where we got Saatchi and Saatchi and M&C Saatchi together, and we held a 40th birthday party at the Saatchi Gallery. And we had all sorts of people. Margaret Thatcher came, as well as Gordon Brown, and we just had great, you know, it was just, and people that had worked here over the years. It was extraordinary. So that was brilliant.
Yeah. In doing this podcast, actually, I've really deliberately tried to seek out particularly significant women who have been creative in advertising as well. And for one reason or another, it's harder than finding middle-aged white guys who I can find all over the place. Do you consider yourself to be in any way a standard bearer for your gender at all in terms of the progress you've made, because there aren't as many of you?
I don't know, maybe I haven't really thought about it in the past, and it's been pointed out to me that maybe I should have done. And I think there is, you know, I've talked sometimes, Rosie Arnold and myself chat about this, because again, we often get talked about because we're probably the last two that are kicking around. But we're sort of, I think, reluctant to stand up and talk about it. Partly maybe it's personality, not feeling confident, but actually I do think that maybe that has been negligent on my part. I feel there is a bit more responsibility. I mean, last year I was at a function, and Barbara Noakes was there, and I had really, I went up to her and I pretty much curtsied. And I literally held her hand and curtsied. I thought, what an idiot. And I realised she had been, you know, her and Susie Henry were the two women that were the only women that I sort of, when I came in to the industry, were there as these extraordinary creative women. And I realised there weren't any role models there. And sadly, there's not that many more in the senior creative director roles at the moment. I think there's way more coming through, and I think in many ways there is a job to be done there to kind of go, you know, there is really no reason why not. I think it's just sort of happened.
Yeah, well, just to let you know that the interesting thing is, when I was talking to people in my department here in LA, I was just saying, does anyone know anyone who, you know, anyone you'd like me to interview? And someone, a lady, girl, woman, I'm not sure what you're supposed to say these days, said, have you interviewed Kate Stanners? And I went, No, not yet. So I've definitely got to get on with that. So just to let you know, there are people over here in LA working at my agency who are like, yeah, go and interview Kate Stanis. So I think that that's really fantastic. And here I am doing that. We're also getting kind of towards the hour mark. So I don't know if there was anything you wanted to say about how things either are now or what's next or, you know, just general thoughts.
If this is a podcast, then what's
Christmas? I mean, I think today, you know, I'm speaking to Kate Stanis. I think
is the
women,
global chief creative
I do
officer
think it is an amazing
society.
Industry for women. I think as an industry, we maybe have neglected that.
That does sound
the perspective
incredibly high powered. I don't know
that,
if you've met.
Because
Kate,
I think if you look at the output of the industry,
I'm sure
sometimes
when you hear
it has
a title
not
like that,
had the kind of female
a
bent that it should have.
Trouser suit,
and I think that possibly is reflective of people who are authoring the work and creating the work. And I don't think that is just creative. I think it is production, it's direction, it's
She's not like that at all, really.
It's
she's
sort of
incredibly
how we portray
nice
and
really
conceive work. So I do think there is something
with.
There that
I first
now,
met her
maybe
in 2000,
a bit late in
2011,
life. In my later years, I feel much more passionate about
searching.
Rather than maybe
and,
just
you know,
as I kind of was embarrassed
times,
to talk about it before
looks,
because there weren't many of us.
And she was just
and I didn't want to make it a big deal. And I just wanted to be good at
when,
what I did.
I'll mention this at the end of the podcast
and
as well, but when I asked
I,
around the people
so
in my agency,
I feel
in LA,
a bit embarrassed. I neglected
like
that part of maybe what I
one
ended
of them
up
Kate's name,
being allowed to do, and I think
I've ended up in an amazing job
because of the people around
would
me.
Like to
I think I've been supported massively by men and women who've allowed me to have a family,
to
sort of control how I want to work. And hopefully make an environment
already,
that is easier for other women to work in.
One of them.
But, and I think that is
really, you
know, really
important.
The women
who really made it to the absolute top of this
I think
industry
our
are,
industry,
you know, depressingly
sort of, I love
further
the way
between
it's
them
changing.
Be.
I love
Kate's
the way
wonderful.
I know pretty
so
much
it was
nothing.
Great to have an hour of
really,
time.
Really
and
enjoy
just to
every
idea,
day
what happens
sitting
when
down
I
with 21-year-olds, 22-year-olds, and learning
at some point,
shit.
A few days later,
because for me,
listen,
the day I
cutting
don't
out
do that is the day to hang up your boots or your, you know,
and
your,
in listening
your
back to what Kate was saying, I got a real sense of there being a real original.
So,
I mean,
so,
you'll hear
I think
over
that's
the course
it.
Of her
it's
career
an, it's
that
an industry
she did
that
things
is
that may not have seemed like the right or logical
changing.
Or
and
perfect
I
thing to do.
I suppose every day I sit there
and
go,
did them anyway
am I relevant?
The true spirit of
am
a creative
I relevant
person.
In any conversation that I'm
one
having?
Or another,
I,
they all
I still review work every day. I've got lots of people waiting outside at the moment
perfect,
about to do one.
You know, and been making those,
you know, so that's what I love.
Career.
And
she's
I love the fact
gone
that
on this interesting
I'll do
trajectory
with
to the point where she is now.
With,
by doing
you know,
what we should all
designers,
be doing, which is
with,
you know, taking a chance, taking a risk,
with writers,
going
with
out and you know, having a go at something that might be a little bit
so
different.
To me, that's
and,
the that's the thing.
Know, she's done that too.
Well, that's great, and I think a really positive
around.
And inspiring
so
note to end on. So, thanks enormously for your time. I know you're incredibly busy, and I'll put this up in a few weeks. I've got a bit of a Christmas backlog of people I've chatted to, but I'll let you know and send it on. But huge thanks, Kate, and it's been a really great chat.
Oh, it's lovely to talk to you. It's lovely to see you as well.
Yeah, you too. Okay, well, have a great rest of your day. And yeah.
I will.
Thanks,
Kate.
Bye. Cheers. Bye.
So much Christmas.